Great. All right, everybody. Thanks for coming today. It's great to see you all. For those who don't know, my name is Yasuto. I've been at 99 for a little over a year now, and I just joined the leadership team a couple of months ago as the Director of Justice and Outreach. And I've had the opportunity to preach at 99 a couple of times, and I also recently started attending seminary, as Pastor Mickey mentioned, through an online program at Fuller Seminary down in Southern California, so I can keep learning more and bringing you guys some more gems. So I'm really excited for the opportunity to share the things I'm learning by preaching a little bit more regularly. So today, believe it or not, we're going to be continuing our series on Ezra. So if you've been coming for a while, you know we've been in the book of Ezra for over 3 months now. And as you might have thought we were done because Mickey just finished all the festivals, but that was more of a side quest to Ezra 3. Now we're done with that. We're going to get into Ezra chapter 4. But I am actually really excited for it. I think it's a really good deep cut in the Old Testament that we don't spend a lot of time in. So first, I'm actually going to start with just a brief recap of the series of Ezra that we've been going through. So by the time of the book of Ezra, the Israelites had been the people of God, but they had been in exile away from their homeland for about 70 years. We all know, if you don't know the history of the Israelites, you at least maybe have heard King David, King Solomon, all those people who were generally righteous kings of Israel who tried to follow God's will. But then after them, there were a number of kings who were unrighteous and who led the people astray. The people of Israel turned into rebellion against God. And eventually, God removed his presence and his protection away from those people. And he sent them into exile. He basically said that since they weren't going to respect their relationship with him, he wasn't going to keep trying to be their God actively. They clearly didn't want him involved, so he allowed them to be taken into exile. But after 70 years, there was a new generation who realized that they wanted to rebuild their relationship with God. And by this time, the temple of God in Jerusalem had been completely destroyed. And the Israelites were now under the Babylonian Empire, again, in exile. But there was a kind king in Babylon at this period, and we learned that God actually led that king to say that whoever among the Israelites wanted to go back to rebuild the temple and worship God again would be permitted to go do so. So there's actually a large group of about 40,000 people who were in exile who decided, let's go back and let's start over, let's try to worship God again. So they migrated back to Jerusalem. The first thing they did when they were there was they started rebuilding the altar of God, which is where they had traditionally worshipped God. They didn't start with rebuilding the temple, they didn't start by rebuilding the walls of the city or even the houses of the city. They focused on correcting the part that they had gotten wrong in the past, which was not fully worshipping God. So they decided to start there and rebuild the altar. So that's the series we're in, about rebuilding the altar in our lives and putting God central in our lives. So then as we learned from Mickey in the last few weeks, they started honoring the ceremonies and festivals that God had set apart for their lives. We learned about the Festival of Tabernacles, which involved showing hospitality to the stranger and to the vulnerable. We learned about the Festival of Trumpets, which is about stopping to recognize God's faithfulness in our lives and expressing our gratitude to him. And we learned about the Day of Atonement. We learned about seeking reconciliation through apology and through absolution of others. We learned about many other festivals. There are 8 in total. So please feel free to go and check out those sermons if you didn't catch them. So now, though, we're turning to Ezra chapter 4. The people have finished building the altar. They resume their worship of God. And now they're going to continue building the temple around the altar to provide more structure and a permanent place for people to come and worship God. So that's where we find ourselves in our scripture reading for today. So we'll read that, Ezra chapter 4, verses 1 through 5. And it says, "When the enemies of Judah and Benjamin heard that the exiles were building a temple for the Lord, the God of Israel, they came to Zerubbabel and to the heads of the families and said, 'Let us help you build, because like you, we seek your God, and we have been sacrificing to him since the time of Esarhaddon, king of Assyria, who brought us here.' But Zerubbabel, Joshua, and the rest of the heads of the families of Israel answered, 'You have no part with us in building a temple to our God. We alone will build it for the Lord, the God of Israel, as King Cyrus, the king of Persia, commanded us.' Then the peoples around them set out to discourage the people of Judah and make them afraid to go on building. They bribed officials to work against them and frustrate their plans during the entire reign of Cyrus, king of Persia, and down to the reign of Darius, king of Persia." So when I first read this, I thought, That was a little harsh. They just like turned them away. That's kind of strange. Some people came and said, we'd love to help out. We worship the same God. We can, you know, we can join forces here. And the Israelites said, no, we'll do this ourselves. It'll just be us. We don't have a place in working on this together. So why wouldn't the Israelites accept the help? Why not join in partnership with these people who claim to worship the same God? And that brings us to the title of the sermon today. Do we all worship the same God? Now, this is a bit of a provocative question in today's day and age, right? I can't tell you how many times I've heard people say, well, most religions are basically the same. They're all about trying to be a good person. So you follow your religion, I'll follow mine. We'll each just figure out what's best for us. So we're going to dig into this question today. Do we all worship the same God? Are all religions basically the same? So we're actually going to start with a bit more context on what was going on with these people in the book of Ezra. Who were these people who came up to the Israelites, and what led them to say that they worshiped the same God? It's important to know that when the Israelites were in exile, they had been taken out of Jerusalem, out of their land, and other people actually moved into their land. And the Bible tells us that they had a very strange experience when they first moved there. So we're going to read 2 Kings 17, verses 24 through 33. It says that the king of Assyria brought people from Babylon, Cuthah, Ava, Hamath, and Sepharvaim, and settled them in the towns of Samaria to replace the Israelites. They took over Samaria and lived in its towns. Now, when they first lived there, they did not worship the Lord, so he sent lions among them, and they killed some of the people. It was reported to the king of Assyria, "The people you deported and resettled in the towns of Samaria do not know what the God of that country requires. He has sent lions among them, which are killing them off, because the people do not know what he requires." It's kind of strange. But the king of Syria then gave this order: "Have one of the priests you took captive from Samaria go back to live there and teach the people what the God of that land requires." So one of the prophets who had been exiled from Samaria came to live in Bethel and taught them how to worship the Lord. Nevertheless, each national group made its own gods in the several towns where they settled, and they set them up in the shrines the people of Samaria had made at the high places. So the people from Babylon made Sukkoth, Benoth. Those from Cuthah made Nergal, and those from Hamath made Ashima. The Avites made Nibaz and Tartak, and the Sepharvites burned their children in the fire as sacrifices to Adramelech and Anamelech, the gods of Sepharvaim. They worshiped the Lord, but they also appointed all sorts of their own people to officiate for them as priests in the shrines at the high places. They worshiped the Lord, but they also served their own gods in accordance with the customs of the nations from which they had been brought. So that's kind of a strange story with the lions coming in and killing people. But what we saw is that the people were trying to make some effort to worship the Lord. They felt like there was something they needed to respect here. But it was kind of a half-hearted effort at best. They already had their systems and their worship in place. So they decided to just tack the God of Israel onto the many gods that they had. So it's important to know this context, that that's the context in which the Israelites were approached by people offering to help them. When these people said that they worshiped the same God, they meant that they worshiped him as one of their gods, nothing special. It's kind of like every god is special in their own way, right? That's kind of how it seems like they saw it. But we see that not all the gods were the same. We saw that some of their gods they believed required sacrificing their kids to them. And these people were not worshiping the one true God. And the Israelites knew that they should not be in partnership with these people. They should not allow their vision of God to be tainted by what these people were bringing in. Now, that practice of the people in Samaria of trying to merge multiple religions together, that's an example of a practice called syncretism. Syncretism is the practice of combining beliefs from different religions, cultures, or schools of thought, thus asserting an underlying unity and allowing for an inclusive approach to other faiths. So on its surface, this sounds kind of nice, right? It's just, let's just focus on the underlying unity of all religions. Let's combine it all together instead of focusing on the differences, who's right, who's wrong. Let's just focus on harmony. Well, there's actually a modern-day version of this, too, that's called Unitarian Universalism. I don't know if anyone's heard of that. There are Unitarian Universalist churches in San Francisco. There are many all across the country. And Unitarian Universalism is essentially the belief that truth and spiritual meaning can be found in all faiths. So we should draw from a wide range of religious teachings to guide our spiritual journey. rather than just choosing one. Essentially, contradictory religions may be equally valid. So they'll read from the Bible, but they'll also read from the Quran. They'll also read from other teachings of other religions and just try to take some general wisdom from whatever someone wants to share that day. Again, it sounds nice, but it suffers from the problem of lacking a connection to reality. In reality, some things are simply true and other things are simply false. So ultimately, we're actually grappling with a bigger question here. Does objective truth exist? It's very true that we all have unique experiences in the world, and so our experiences in the world are subjective in many ways, but they're also objective in other very important ways. We simply can't operate in reality if we insist that everything is subjective. So let's just look at a few laws of physics, for example. Is gravity subjective? Or do we have to grapple with the same gravitational force when we jump into the air or when we fall off of something? It pulls us all down in the same way, regardless of what we believe about it. Is the rising and the setting of the sun subjective? Or do we all need to build our lives around the idea that sometimes it's day and sometimes it's night, no matter what we wish to be true? Though, of course, daytime and nighttime can last for different periods of time in different parts of the world, which is an interesting thing, right? So our experiences of day and night might differ in some ways from one culture to another. So there is some subjective experience, but we're all experiencing the same sun. We're just having different experiences with that sun. And finally, is the occurrence of death subjective? Or is that an objective reality that we all have to grapple with sooner or later? My point is that we can't actually live our lives insisting that everything is subjective. We have to live our lives with the objective reality that exists and that impacts all of us, whether we like it or not. So why does this matter? Could we just say that, yes, the laws of physics are objective, but spirituality is just a different kind of thing? We all have a subjective experience with spirituality, and we need to honor that. I do agree with parts of that. I do believe that we have some subjective experiences, but what we also need to grapple with is that there's an objective answer to the question, does God exist or not? I actually think that when people say all religions are basically the same, what I think they're actually saying is all religions are basically false. They're just wishful thinking, so you might as well let people believe whatever they want to believe if it helps them get through their life. Because you can't quite say that they're all the same and say that they're all equally true when they contradict each other in ways. So getting to this question then, let's start just with does God exist or not. The problem that we face when we think that there is no objective existence of a particular God is that virtually everyone acts like God exists. And I'll explain what I mean by that, even if they don't want to admit it. We act like God exists anytime we're outraged when we see someone do something that seems wrong to us. The question is, how do we define what's right and wrong? Is that objective or subjective? Some people would say that morality is totally subjective and that we see that in the ways that different cultures have different norms. But we have to admit that there are some fundamental truths we believe to hold to be true across all cultures. So the pastor Tim Keller made this point in his book, The Reason for God. Here's a quote. He said, "Though we have been taught that all moral values are relative to individuals and cultures, we can't live like that. In actual practice, we inevitably treat some principles as absolute standards by which we judge the behavior of those who don't share our values. What gives us the right to do that if all moral beliefs are relative? Nothing gives us the right. Yet we can't stop it. People who laugh at the claim that there is a transcendent moral order do not think that racial genocide is just impractical or self-defeating, but that it is wrong. The Nazis who exterminated Jews may have claimed that they didn't feel it was immoral at all, but we don't care. We don't care if they sincerely felt they were doing a service to humanity. They ought not to have done it." And as an aside, the same can be said about what is happening in Gaza right now, right? So Tim Keller continues, "If there is no God, then there is no way to say any one action is moral and another immoral. But only I like this. If that is the case, who gets the right to put their subjective, arbitrary moral feelings into law? The fact is, if there is no God, then all moral statements are arbitrary. All moral valuations are subjective and internal, and there can be no external moral standard by which a person's feelings and values are judged. So if you believe human rights are a reality, then it makes much more sense that God exists than that he does not. If you insist on a secular view of the world and yet you continue to pronounce some things right and some things wrong, then I hope you see the deep disharmony between the world your intellect has devised and the real world and God that your heart knows exists. This leads us to a crucial question. If a premise, there is no God, leads to a conclusion you know isn't true, napalming babies is culturally relative, then why not change the premise? That was a long quote. But it is just so powerful because it really causes us to wrestle with the idea of whether there is an objective nature to God and the world that we need to explore and address. So if it's fair to say that God likely exists, then the question is now, do we all worship the same God? Then what we are asking is, are the gods between religions fundamentally different? And do some religions worship God more accurately than others? There's also the question of, do all Christians really worship the same idea of God too? This also then causes us to ask how important it is for us to know if we're worshiping the true God or not. So there's a quote from A.W. Tozer that helps us grapple with that question. He says, "What comes into our minds when we think about God is the most important thing about us. We tend, by a secret law of the soul, to move toward our mental image of God." So what does that mean, to move toward our mental image of God? If we think that God is a strict ruler who's casting judgment on the world, then we're prone to become strict people who are casting judgment on others. If we think that God is a Christian nationalist who believes that Americans should be prioritized above all other people, then we'll treat non-Americans worse than we treat others. But if we believe that God is a loving God who cares for the oppressed and the immigrant and the orphan, then we'll go out of our way to care for the oppressed and the immigrant and the orphan. You see what I'm getting at? So what we believe is important to God ends up being what we treat as the most important thing in our lives as well. So for atheists and agnostics, I think this is still true. If we believe that God is either absent or uncaring or disinvolved with the world, then it's also easy for us to fall into apathy for others, especially for those who disagree with us. Now, I know that there are a lot of very caring atheists and agnostics, but for those who don't believe in a personal God, it does become necessary to wrestle with why it matters for us to have compassion for all of humanity if we don't see that compassion as a central part of the world around us. And I'll just share a little bit of my own story. So I asked you to think about, at the beginning, your story for how you first learned about God, your first impressions of God. So for myself, I grew up in a very strict, conservative Southern Baptist church, and I was taught that God was always watching me and that he was going to catch me if I did anything wrong. So I felt like I needed to be very careful to not do anything wrong so I wouldn't get God's judgment. And slowly but surely, I became a more judgmental person. As I became a teenager, I started watching others carefully to see if they were following God's commands or not. And if I saw them slip up, I would think, they're going to get God's judgment. So I was becoming my mental image of God. And honestly, it was exhausting. When I got to college, I started to realize that I was actually pretty miserable living this version of Christianity. I was always so worried about offending God and receiving his judgment that I couldn't ever really just enjoy my life. I wasn't appreciating the beauty of the world that God created and the goodness that he also put inside me that I should be excited by and live into. Only later in my journey did I start to view God as primarily being a loving father who was guiding and correcting me when I strayed onto the wrong path, but who fundamentally was doing so out of love for me. And changing my perception of God truly changed my life. I'll talk a little bit more about that towards the end of the sermon. So let's get back to the idea of, do we all worship the same God? Are all religions worshiping the objectively accurate version of who God is? As nice as it would be to say that all religions are basically true, it's just not possible because they directly contradict each other at times. And if two points directly contradict each other, they can't both be true. Here are a few examples. If you look at Islam versus Christianity, we see that Christianity claims that Jesus is the Son of God who sacrificed himself for us in a way that takes away the penalty for our sins so that we can immediately have a reconciled relationship with God. Islam does believe in Jesus, but they claim that Jesus is just another prophet who was not sacrificed for us,
So we're still responsible for our sins, and we will be judged by God based on whether the good we did in the world outweighs the bad we did in the world. Though they say God may decide to grant us mercy. We don't know. Let's look at Hinduism versus Christianity. Christianity claims that there is one true God, who is a personal God who loves us and who wants to be involved in each of our lives. Hinduism is a bit more complicated in that it accepts a variety of different beliefs about God. Some Hindus believe there are many gods. Others believe there's more of an impersonal force behind the universe. But they do not believe that there is one exclusive personal God who wants to have a relationship with us. And finally, we'll just look at Buddhism versus Christianity. Christianity claims that after death, there is an afterlife that we will go to in which we can either live in a perfect world in fellowship with God, or we can live in a painful world apart from the presence of God. Buddhism claims that after death, we may be reincarnated into the same earth and keep living through cycles of life here until we discover enlightenment in nirvana and can finally escape the cycle of suffering and rebirth. So it sounds nice to say that all religions are basically true, but it's actually impossible. They have very different beliefs, very contradictory beliefs. And what I'm not saying is that there's nothing good about other religions, nothing to admire or respect, but that you have to grapple with which version of Jesus is true. Either he's the Son of God or he's just a man. Which version of God is true? Is he a personal God who wants to have a relationship with us? Or is he a more impersonal God, or is it many gods? Is there an afterlife in which we can spend an eternity with God? Or is it just reincarnation? Do we keep coming back to this earth? They can't all be true, so we need to grapple with it. We can't just wave away these questions and say that everybody is right in their own minds, just like we can't say that gravity is subjective or the existence of the sun is subjective. We have to live in reality in which some things are true and some things are simply false. So why do we follow Christianity then? Why did the Israelites in the book of Ezra believe that it was so important for them to follow the one true God? Ultimately, I believe that Christianity uniquely answers the question of how we can live in a world in which there is so much love that we feel for each other, but also so much pain that we see people experience. Christianity uniquely answers the question of how there can be a God who has established a high standard of what is right and wrong, of what it means to treat other people the way we want to be treated, but how our world can still be filled with evil people who inflict suffering on others. Now, what is that answer? I'll tell you a little bit more about my own story again in terms of how I discovered the beauty of a relationship with God. So as I mentioned, while I was in college, I started to realize that my view of God was really looking at him as an angry judge who was just looking for me to slip up. And I realized that that was a toxic idea of God. It was making me miserable, and I could no longer see how that God could really be real. So I gave up Christianity altogether. I realized that I had taken for granted that it was true, because ever since I was a kid, that's just what I was taught. But I had never really evaluated whether or not it was true compared to other religions. There were so many other versions of God that people believed that I had never even considered. So I decided that it was time to start from scratch, now that I was an adult, see if I could figure out who God really is. And over the next few years, I followed up on that, and I started to explore the teachings of various religions and the basic ideas of theology more generally. And I took a philosophy class in college called Moral Philosophy and read what various thinkers of philosophy have theorized about the nature of our world over time. And the same critical question did keep coming up. How could a good God exist in a world of so much suffering? Seems like we're all trying to grapple with that in some way. And as I described earlier, it seemed clear to me that God does exist, since we all have this innate belief that there's an objective morality that is bigger than all of us, even if not all of us explicitly state that. That seems to be how we act. So then who is God, and why does he allow the world to be this way? Well, I discovered that Christianity fundamentally answers this question in the most comprehensive and beautiful way. Here is the beauty of the Christian answer to this question. God does not want to force us to worship him, so he has given us free will. But the existence of free will means that humans may hurt other humans, but God couldn't stop all the pain without infringing on our free will. But rather than just sitting distantly from us and seeing us in pain, God loved us so much that he humbled himself, became a man in the person of Jesus, and came to suffer alongside us. God ultimately loves us so much that he sacrificed himself for us to take onto himself the pain and penalty of the suffering that we humans have created so that we can now be reconciled into a fulfilling relationship with him. That is the idea of God that we worship, a God of love and a God who is even humble, a God who actually puts himself, who actually puts others before himself. And this reconciles a lot of those philosophical ideas of how could suffering exist and God allow it. It seems that God is allowing us to have free will so that we can be independent beings who have the decisions about what we want to do in our lives. But again, unlike other religions, God doesn't just sit in a distant way watching us and judging us based on whether or not we fulfill his will in this world. He comes down and he partners with us. He walks alongside us, and he even suffered alongside us. And I thought that is actually very unique because that shows that God truly believes this period of our lives, this walking through this earth, is going to be worth it for us to be able to have a relationship with him. And even more so, he sacrificed himself for us so that we could really have that relationship with him. So this is why the Israelites in the book of Ezra didn't want to allow other people to come into their project of building the temple and bring in their own visions of other gods, because it would taint the ability for the Israelites to focus on the nature of the true God. We even saw, again, how some of the people were sacrificing their kids. We see how there are ways in which, as we allow our vision of God to shift, it begins to shift how we operate. And I think that that's true, again, with American Christianity today. The most prominent, most vocal forms of it tend to be filled with this image of power, this image of America being primary and more important than other places in the world that just don't really align with the Bible. It seems that we're allowing other visions of God to taint what the Bible has taught us about who God is. So who do we become when this story is what we believe about God? When this is what we believe, we become people who respect the independence and inherent value of others, just like God has respected our independence and our inherent value in giving us free will. We also become people who live selflessly and are willing to make sacrifices to help others flourish in their lives, just as God lived selflessly towards us and has sacrificed himself for us. Because that is the nature of the God that we serve. That is the type of person we start to become. Now, what does this mean for other religions? This is potentially just as provocative of a question in American Christian church, because there's this question of what does this mean for people who worship inaccurate versions of God? Some Christians would say confidently, well, they're all going to hell. They got it wrong, and so they're going to be condemned to punishment because of their inaccurate beliefs. It may come as a surprise, but I don't believe that God necessarily condemns all people who have inaccurate beliefs about him. Now, I want to be clear that our salvation only comes through Jesus. It is only because Jesus sacrificed himself for our sins that we can be fully reconciled to God. But I also want to note that God has been doing a work in people all over the world across all of time. And we see that in the Old Testament. There were people in the Old Testament who were trying to follow God, who were dedicating themselves to God, and they did not know that their salvation would come through Jesus. They did their best to follow God with the information that they had, and they trusted that God would make a way to redeem them, which he ultimately did do in the person of Jesus, when Jesus was born and sacrificed himself. So now that Jesus has been sacrificed, do we all need to explicitly know that in order to be reconciled to God? And the question that came up when I was a kid was, well, what does that mean for someone who lives on a remote island in the 13th century who never heard about Jesus? Did God condemn that person for not having faith in a story that they never heard? Well, actually, when I grew up, Christians in that church would say, yes, God condemns them. He just decided they don't get to be saved. It didn't really make sense to me. And the reason it didn't make sense is because it doesn't sound like the God we just talked about, who came and sacrificed himself for all people, that God would just condemn billions of people to eternity away from him because he chose not to allow them to be exposed to the story of Jesus. Again, it doesn't sound like the God of the Bible to me. And in fact, Jesus told an interesting parable about two different servants with different amounts of information about what their master wants them to do. So we see in Luke 12, 47 through 48 in the Message translation, it says, "The servant who knows what his master wants and ignores it, or insolently does whatever he pleases, will be thoroughly thrashed. But if he does a poor job through ignorance, he'll get off with a slap on the hand. Great gifts mean great responsibilities. Greater gifts, greater responsibilities." So again, that's a Message translation. And what I take this verse to mean is that Jesus is acknowledging people have different amounts of information. Some of us know more about the nature of God than others. And again, that doesn't mean that there's a subjective reality to who God is. It means that there's one objective God, and some of us are a little closer in our understanding of who that God is, and others are trying, but a little bit off. And again, God didn't give all knowledge about himself to all people at the same time, right? We know that that's true, even again, looking at the Old Testament. So does that mean that people who are earnestly seeking God but have some inaccurate information about him could still be covered by the sacrifice of Jesus and receive God's forgiveness and experience a relationship with God? I believe that is possible, but I don't believe we know exactly how God is going to judge different people based on the information they have. But I think what's important then is for us to really focus on what does this mean for us. For those of us who have this information, who know the story of Jesus' sacrifice, God is calling on us to respond. And for those of us who are already Christians, who have responded, we have to acknowledge that we may have some inaccurate understandings of God as well. That's why it's important for us to keep getting to know him better. There are many Christians who seem to know just the basic story of Christianity, but they don't seem to know enough of the details about the love of God for their life to be transformed by who Jesus is, what he believed in, and what he taught us to live out in our lives. Again, I've been harping on the far right. I'll just do it one more time. Does it seem like the Christians on the far right of the political spectrum have a perfect understanding of the nature of God? For those who are rejecting immigrants and the oppressed, it seems like they're missing some key elements of the nature of God and honestly teachings that are right there in the Bible about how we are to be loving to the immigrant, to those who are less fortunate than us. It seems like there's some work that a lot of Christians could do to study the Bible more, to learn more about God. And I think that's something true for all of us. There's often something that we're missing, you know, blind spots that we have that we should continue to reflect on. So as we start to come to a close, I'll leave you with the idea that there are different levels of knowledge about God. Just as there might be different levels of knowing about another person. There's knowing about someone as just an idea. There's knowing about someone as an acquaintance. And then there's knowing someone as a close friend. An example that came to mind for me is there's a historical figure that I admire who's Martin Luther King Jr. I think he had an incredible worldview that I would want to learn from, right? And I just know about him as an idea, though, really. I know some of the things he said, some of the things he believed in, and I say, yeah, I generally agree with that. I actually have a book of some of his writings. I haven't read it. But I'm like, you know, I generally think he's great. And, you know, over time, I'll learn a little bit more. But how much better would it be if I had gotten to meet him and just have a couple conversations with him as an acquaintance, ask him some questions, clarify some things, you know, and learn a little bit more, understand him a little bit more deeply. Imagine if I got to spend time with him as a close friend, if I got to have meals with him over and over again and really hear more about his background and what pains him, what excites him, what experiences he had through his life that shaped him. Then I would really understand his ideas more and more deeply, and then I'd be able to live out more of what his beliefs were if I believed that as a mentor to me, he could be someone that I should imitate. Now, what's incredible is we have the opportunity to get to know God as a close friend. And there are actually practical ways to do that. This last slide here, or second last slide, is that we've been given this incredible book about God, about who he is, called the Bible. And a lot of us take that for granted. Again, like my book on Martin Luther King Jr., we just leave it as a nice thing to maybe look at one day. If you're not in the habit of reading your Bible regularly, what if you just read one chapter a day? Like, again, it doesn't have to be some big thing. I always recommend just starting with the New Testament because I think it's the easiest for us to understand. Just start with the book of Matthew, the story of Jesus, read a little bit each day. Eventually, you can get to the Old Testament. I think there's a lot of good things to learn about God in there too. But again, just take it day by day. And then, if you try talking to God every day like you would talk to a close friend, I truly believe you'll get to know Him better. And this is the incredible thing that I think can be hard to like really wrap our minds around: the idea that prayer is actually an opportunity for us to get to know God. I recommend starting with the Lord's Prayer. That's typically what I do each day. I just start with the Lord's Prayer. That's it's when Jesus was asked, how should we pray? He said, here's how you should pray. And it just helps us to think through a few different phases of worshiping God, asking for His will to be done in the world, asking for His help in our daily lives with our daily bread, and then confessing anything that we feel that we've done wrong against Him. And then, again, closing with being able to forgive others as well. And then I would say just tell God whatever's on your mind and ask Him for help with whatever's going on in your life that day. Because what is incredible is that we have the gift of getting to know a personal God who loves us and who wants to have a relationship with us. So this last slide here, and then Mickey, if you could come on up, is that Jesus says in Revelation chapter 3, verse 20, here I am. I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I will come in and eat with that person and they with me. All we have to do is let Him in. So let's close our eyes for a minute and let's just have a period of prayer. What I want to emphasize today is just that no matter where we are on our journeys, we all have the opportunity to get to know God better. But we all have to believe that it's valuable enough to get to know the Creator of our universe and to get to know more about what it is He wants for our lives. So I'm just asking if you could just take a minute to just pray and just offer to God for Him to come and play more of an active role in your life.